Good morning. Welcome to The Coffee Table, right here on AM 890 KBBI Homer, listener-supported public radio. I'm your host, Kathleen Gustafson. This morning, you'll hear a recording of last Wednesday's KPC Showcase discussion about changes over time in local fisheries. You'll hear from Dave Acheson, Kachemak Bay Campus Showcase Series Evening Coordinator, and Hope Roberts and Brent Johnson. They'll be talking about their experience, sport, and commercial fishing on the peninsula. And then you'll hear full presentations from Sue Mauger, Science and Executive Director at Cook Inlet Keeper, and Dr. Eric Shane, Fisheries Biologist from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The discussion was entitled, A Changing Kenai Peninsula, Climate Change's Possible Impact on the Future of Hunting and Fishing. This first part of the discussion, fishing, was recorded live on Wednesday, December 2nd via Zoom and Kachemak Bay Campus in Soldotna. At the end of this discussion, you'll hear a preview of the second part in this series, focusing on wildlife. For now, let's get to fisheries. Here's Dave Acheson, author, fisher, and evening coordinator for the Kachemak Bay Campus Showcase Series.
Really quickly about some of the changes I've seen in my time here fishing on the peninsula. The biggest change, I think, is the king salmon fishery on the streams of the lower Kenai Peninsula, but also on the Kenai River. As a lot of people know, the king fishery's been either closed or it's been limited to catch and release the last probably 6 or 7 years. And the good old days weren't that long ago. My nephew, who is 25, and he was here when he was 12, so that was only 13 years ago. One day, he caught 3 kings in the slot limit, which was 44 to 55 inches. And I think the largest one was over 55, but there was 4 of us in a 16-foot drift boat trying to handle the fish, so I figured we better let it go. And it was common back then to get a fish. I fished a lot, kingfish, but it was common to get several 70 or 80 pounders in a season, at least 1 or 2, and a lot in the 40 to 60 pound range. Now a 40, 50 pounder is a really big fish and people will be surprised. And I've talked to people who are new to Alaska who've only maybe been here for 5 or 6 years and they're like, wow, they think I'm pulling their legs sometimes. The other thing is like the streams on the lower Kenai Peninsula, the Nilchik, Deep Creek, Anchor River, used to go down there, they would open Memorial Day and be open for 3 to 5 weekends. And Memorial Day wasn't always the best, but the second and third weekend, you could pretty much fire up the grill because you were bringing a king home. And so that's, it's something that a big change I've noticed too. Also, when I go fishing, I go home and I write down what I was using, where I was using it, so I can remember from year to year. And I also keep track of observations. And so I have a pond behind the house, and it really, the ice out or freeze up on that pond coincides with all the lakes in the Swan Lake, Swanson River area. It coincides with the low-lying lakes. And for 20 years, the ice went out on May 13th, or so occasionally it was the 12th or the 14th. Around May 13th. Now, last 10 years, that has changed. I think 4 or 5 years ago, it went out a month early. And freeze up was usually the end of October, the 19th to like the 25th or so. That has changed too. I think 4 or 5 years ago, I actually went canoeing on the Swan Lake area on the second weekend in November, which was really unheard of. So those are some of the big changes that I've seen. And also, this hasn't deal with the fisheries, but I live out past Sterling, and we've had fire for the last 8 years. I've been prepared to evacuate because of fire. So those are some of the changes that I've seen. I'm going to turn it over to Brent Johnson, and he's going to talk about some of the commercial fishing and some of the things that he's seen. And then we're going to turn it over after Brent to Hope. Are you there, Brent?
I'm here, Dave. I'm Brent Johnson. I was born in Seldovia. I lived 4 years in Homer, and then my parents homesteaded in Clam Gulch in 1959, and I've been here ever since. one of the things I did growing up, my dad was a private land surveyor. And so I spent years surveying with him. And so then later I got interested in history, and I'm the president of Kasiloth Historical Association. But what you're looking at on the screen right now is special instructions for a survey that's done in 1897. And you will notice it says that this is going to be for to survey number 83, Kasiloth, dig how they spell Kasiloth River, Cook Inlet, and it's for the Arctic Fishing Company. So that was the cannery at the mouth of the Kasiloth River. Now, here we are, July 18, 1897, and we have this gentleman. I've gotten his survey notes, and he says on July 17th at 11th hour, 40th minute PM, so this is like 20 minutes before midnight, he's doing a monument observation of Polaris. That's the star on its eastern elongation. And anyway, he's doing this. And then if you drop on down here at 7 a.m., so he's at 20 minutes before midnight, he takes a star shot. I've done that with my father before. Pretty unusual. I only did it a couple of times, but they didn't have corners then, so that's how they had to get going. At 7 a.m., he gets back up. He says he lays off the azimuth of Polaris, and he's doing this survey, mark the true meridian, through determination by driving a picket, blah, blah, blah. And then you get down here at the last paragraph, he says, beginning at a point at ordinary high water mark on Kasiloth River, which is also the beginning corner of original survey, number 83. It not being a suitable place to establish a corner on account of ice. When I read these survey notes, that blew me away. What in the world are we doing with so much ice at the mouth of the Kasiloth River, up on the bank, which is where the survey is going, that they can't set a corner? I tell you what, that hasn't happened there in a long time. I don't know the answer, but that is amazing. So when I moved up to Clam Gulch and my parents homesteaded, my mom decided to start setting it, and she did that in 1962. And here is a picture of my mom. She's there improperly holding the fish by the tail. And this is my brother. He's also improperly holding the fish by the tail while he's trying to pick it out of our little set net. And there is my own sweet self, as my children might say, typically with my hands in my pockets. But the thing I want to mention here is we started off on June 8, 1962 fishing. And the way we got here to this picture is we would row a boat across a lake, and then we would walk a trail for a quarter mile. And then you see this bluff behind my mom here. We would just walk down this bluff and back up this bluff. On June 8 in 1962, according to my mom and my sister, because I don't remember this, but I was there. When we went to get in that boat, there was a little bit of water in the bottom, and there was ice in the bottom of the boat. That seems pretty wild to me. Wouldn't happen these days. And I checked with the Kenai temperature, and the lowest it got in Kenai on June 8 was 38 degrees. So I can't guarantee you that that's true, but that's what my mom and my sister say. So I've been involved in commercial fishing then since 1962. And 2019 was a sort of a dreadful year. And so here you see Kenai July high temperatures from 1973 to 2019. And in 2019, the high temperature at the Kenai Airport was 89 degrees. And you can see these other records over that period of time. But that particular year was so hot and the streams were so low that it was really hard on salmon. It was a brutal summer for them. So 1973 was the year I graduated from high school. That's the only significance there. And 2019 is because I haven't, I wrote this last year and I haven't redone it. That is this one particular study. So in that same period of time, 1973 to 2019, these are the average July temperature at the Kenai Airport. It exceeded 55 degrees for the last 7 years in a row, and for 20 of 25 since 1997. For the earlier time frame, it exceeded 55 degrees only four times in the 24 years between 1973 and 1996. So you can see that it certainly appears to have had a warming trend, and there is the reference source where I got that information. Here is the Kenai minimum January temperatures for the same time period. And there you see minus 40, 90 degrees. Those are what you would call brutal temperatures right there. And the only thing significant there is that they are, tend to be a little bit longer ago. You'll see 2017 minus 30 degrees, that's bad enough. But these other temperatures there, I'm telling you, those are downright brutal. In 1973 to 2019, the Kenai average January temperature for the earlier time period was an average of 14 degrees. And for the 1997 to 2019 average was 16.7 degrees. So there again, you see a fairly significant warming. Then last of all, I've been fishing and cooking it now for quite a while. And I'm gonna give you a little interesting observation. So commercial fishing in Cook Inlet, they had some salteries that started earlier, but the first cannery came in 1882. And so in 1911, that was the first time that in Cook Inlet, the harvest of sockeye exceeded 1 million fish. So then they fished on here for another 25 years or so. And in 1936, the harvest exceeded 2 million fish. So, you know, people want to think that when time immemorial far back, that there were just jillions of fish. And that, you know, that when mankind came, we just kind of did all sorts of bad things. But the record bears out that there probably weren't jillions of fish, that there probably was sufficient number of fish for the natives that used them for bears and birds. But when the canneries came, you'll notice that they didn't right away start harvesting millions and millions of fish. It's another huge spell, almost 50 years there between 1936 and 1982, when the harvest of sockeye in Cook Inlet for the first time exceeded 3 million fish. Since then, here's the years where the commercial harvest has exceeded 3 million fish. You can see them there on your screen. Now, during this period of time from 1983 to current, there's been a dramatic change in the number of fish that are harvested in the sport fishery and in the personal use fishery. So I had that added in here and studied out at one time. I used to know the number. It's I don't remember what it is now, but it adds on to this number significantly. So all I'm saying is that it appears to me that there are several factors that work together that made sockeye propagation really good in the 80s and 90s and even the 2000s. Part of that had to do with management, but I think some of that had to do with good temperatures. In the last few years, the temperatures are actually getting too high and we're having new problems with that. Okay, back to you, David.
All right, thanks, Brent. That was really interesting. I'm gonna turn it over to Hope Roberts now. She could tell us a little bit about herself.
I'm Hope Roberts. I live in Valdez, Alaska. I'm Klinkenath Baskin. I work for Chugach Regional Resources Commission. I'm the intertribal liaison there. I just started October 1st. And before that, my husband and I started a fishing charter called Surreal Saltwaters. We've been working out of Valdez Port for 3 years. When this opportunity came up, I asked some other captains if their observations were a little different. In the last few years, they've noticed the same things. But before that, they didn't really have observations because the fish were still real big prior to when we started. I first noticed the water temperature because we were marine mammal harvesters as well. I almost lost a seal, so I jumped in after it. And the water was 42 degrees. So it took me 10 seconds to retrieve it, get it back in the boat. And then, so I started taking notice of the temperature of the water. The water then was still 42 degrees throughout the summer while we were fishing for ourselves. And then in 2018, the water was still about that. And then 2019, we were noticing that the fish were becoming more in the 100 to 199 pound range, the halibut, I mean. And I watched the water temperature because although I don't like going in the water, if I were to have to go in the water, I always wanted to know the temperature because of the retrieval I did a few years back. And I noticed that the water was 52 degrees even in late July, which was obviously a lot higher than 42 degrees. Most of the other charter captains didn't really have any complaints about the fish because the fish were still, we were still pulling in decent numbers of 200 pound halibut. And then last year, we were, almost all of us were catching 100 to 199 pound fish, if that. I think we still had, the winner of the Derby was a 224 pound fish, which was actually pretty small. Because the other ones, the prior 2 years, were 285 pounds. And those are some of the things that I've noticed about temperature changes. There were a couple of hot, hot days in Valdez, but nothing really that I was worried about, but mostly we were in the water anyway. Last year was kind of hard for a lot of us to get, you know, bigger fish. I went and looked back at the Valdez Derby weekly winners, and almost all of the first and second place Derby winners were in the 100 pound range for 2020. I believe there were at least a couple in 2019 that were at least 200 pound weekly winners. That is what I had to share about, you know, temperature changes, and I'm going to be sure and note the temperature difference next summer when we fish. Hopefully it won't get any hotter. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, Hope. Now we're going to turn it over to Dr. Schoen and Sue Mauger. Let you go, Eric.
Awesome. Thanks, Dave. I'm Eric Schoen. I'm a fisheries biologist at UAF, studying climate change, particularly how it relates to Alaskan salmon for the last couple of years. I'm going to show you some of our findings and highlight some research from a few colleagues today. Just kind of a brief overview of some of the recent science on what climate change means for Alaskan salmon, in particular Cook Inlet and Kenai salmon, and talk a little bit about our fisheries. Like I said, I'm a fisheries biologist at the Institute of Arctic Biology here at UAF. So just a little bit about me. This is my migration. I started out my juvenile rearing phase, was in Juneau, lived on the beach there as a little kid, migrated to Fairbanks as a kid. Spent my early adulthood, we'll call it my early marine stage, to go with the metaphor here, in Anchorage, where I met my wife, Jenny. And then we returned to Fairbanks to spawn and raise our two little kids here. And we spent a lot of time on interior rivers now, although we do make it down to South Central at least once a year to visit my parents and make sure they know what an ocean bright king looks like. Spent a lot of time on the Kenai for fun, and I've been lucky enough to spend some time on the Kenai for work too, and it's an amazing place. So definitely near and dear to my heart. So today I'm gonna be talking about, I'm gonna give you kind of a roadmap here. We're gonna talk about changes facing Alaska's salmon ecosystems. I'm mainly gonna focus on freshwater habitats and the watersheds that they drain, because that's my area of expertise. But I'll just say right up front, the ocean is critically important to salmon, obviously. There are huge changes happening in the ocean too that affect our salmon runs. We'll touch on this briefly. I won't say a whole lot about it today, but those are really important as well. So we'll talk a little bit about climate change in terms of air temperature and precipitation changes. We'll talk about how our landscapes are changing. So things like melting glaciers, wetland loss, wildfire, and then some things that aren't necessarily directly linked to climate change, like human development and invasive species, but those interact pretty strongly with climate change. So it's important to keep that in mind. And then how that affects salmon habitat. So habitat can be lost or gained due to climate effects. We can have changes in stream flow and water temperature. And then what does that mean for salmon? So that could affect salmon numbers and body size, and it could obviously affect our fisheries. And I'll start out by briefly summarizing some findings from a study we wrote a couple of years ago focusing on the Kenai River. Everybody here obviously knows it's just a really special watershed, extraordinarily productive and diverse, sports world-class fisheries. But obviously there've been a lot of challenges in recent years. Challenges as far as smaller fish, fewer fish, fisheries closures. So these are still extremely productive runs when you look at them across, you know, compared to runs across the world. It's just a tremendous resource, even considering these recent challenges. But it, you know, has prompted a lot of people to wonder, are these really extraordinarily valuable salmon runs and are fisheries resilient to climate change? And if not, what can we do to help them become more resilient? Or what can we do not to make things worse? Alaska has warmed at more than twice the rate of the rest of the US over the past 60 years. That little image there is a world map with the darker red and brown colors showing faster warming. So the Arctic in general and Alaska in particular is just warming at a tremendous rate. In the Kenai River watershed in particular, National Weather Service records, and thanks Brent for giving more detail on this, but just to echo what he said, we've seen rapidly warming air temperatures during all seasons, especially winter. We've seen drier summers and wetter falls. And climate projections from UAF predict that the warming is going to continue or accelerate in the future. So it's not slowing down. We don't really know what's going to happen with precipitation. Models have different predictions on that. But we might expect these changes to be felt differently depending where you are in the landscape. So this is a map of the Kenai River watershed. Sure everybody knows this, but you know, it flows from these high glaciated mountains in the east through the main stem down to lowlands in the west where it drains into Cook Inlet. And salmon live throughout the watershed in these just remarkably different habitats. So these top three photos are taken by Ben Meyer, who is a master's student at UAF and just graduated recently. He studied juvenile coho and chinook in Beaver Creek in the Kenai Lowlands, that's the left picture, the Russian River up in the mountains, and then Ptarmigan Creek, which drains a glacially influenced basin into Kenai Lake. We have obviously big glacial rivers on the Kenai and throughout Alaska. So this is the Resurrection River. These rivers tend to be thought of mainly as migration corridors for salmon. They're too silty and the banks are too unstable to provide a lot of food. Although we found evidence that salmon actually can make a living under certain conditions in rivers like this, like the Susitna. But typically these are, you know, lower productivity rivers compared to the Clearwater streams. But then the Kenai River main stem and rivers flowing out of glacial lakes in general can be extremely productive and pretty special resources because these rivers tend to have late runs of salmon. So the late sockeye and king runs in the Kenai, they spawn and rear in the main stem below these huge lakes, Kenai Lake and Skelak Lake. And that, because salmon are available, there's an early run and a late run, that makes salmon more available to people and to the other animals that eat them. And we might expect all these different types of habitats to respond differently to climate change. So like in a super hot, dry year, a lowland stream fed by wetlands might get really hot and might dry up. Whereas a big glacial river might actually, the water level is gonna come up because the glacier's melting faster, it might get more silty. So we might expect that basically the landscape to filter this signal from climate change and have different effects on salmon in different places. And Ben Meyer, the grad student I just mentioned, he took an in-depth look at this for his master's project, which he just defended this summer. And he actually modeled, so he used modeled climate data for the rest of the current century. And he modeled what the stream temperatures are gonna do in these different watersheds in the Kenai. And then he modeled juvenile salmon growth. So if the climate models are right, which of course they're not, but it's gives us an interesting way to think about the future, some scenarios, what would we expect to happen to juvenile salmon growth? And he found that warming, it did have diverse effects across the landscape. However, by once you get 60 years out, most of those effects are negative. So salmon, they've gotten past, it's warmed up past the optimal temperature for growth, and now it's starting to get a little bit too hot. So in general, that, you know, there was, his models predicted there'd be some beneficial effects of these temperatures, but mostly negative effects. Okay, so that's the effects of climate per se. Also, like I said, there's these massive landscape changes happening. So drying wetlands. The wetlands in the Kenai lowlands have shrunk dramatically since the 1950s. This is data from Ed Berg from the Kenai Refuge. We're seeing much more frequent wildfires. And obviously last year was a huge wildfire across the state, Swan Lake, and, you know, fires all through the interior. So wildfires are becoming more common, and the area burned is becoming larger each year. And then the human development is obviously affecting the landscape as well, and in an interactive way. So this is the a zoom-in image of the lower Kenai River area with Kenai and Soldotna as the two big red globs there. I put KPC on there. If we were in person, we'd be sitting underneath that little logo. So we looked at aerial photos, and we found that the footprint of human development has expanded more than 20 times since the 1950s in the Kenai River watershed overall. And obviously, if you live there, you know this already, but the development's concentrated right along the lower Kenai River, within a kilometer of the river. And that lower river is key habitat for late run kings. I guess a naive take on this might be, well, development is threatening fish, but maybe a glass half full take would be that, wow, we have this phenomenal salmon run that's flows right through two of our cities. So I think that's pretty cool. It just means we have to take care for how we treat that habitat. It's a really important habitat. And then I'm gonna talk a little bit more about glaciers, because I find glaciers super fascinating. So obviously glaciers are retreating really fast. This image shows, this is like a 3D perspective based on satellite photos. And the red outline shows where the Skilak Glacier was, its footprint in 1952. And the Skilak, obviously, it drains into the Kenai River, into Skilak Lake and into the Kenai River. So one of the biggest sources of water of the Kenai. And then, so over the next couple of decades, up to the late 70s, that's the gold outline, the glacier thinned quite a bit, but it didn't retreat very much. And then all of a sudden, it retreated fast, and it created this new proglacial lake at the toe of Skilak Glacier. And this is happening, obviously, throughout the world, and in Alaska, this is happening at a tremendous rate. And I think, I mean, we all know, so exit glaciers retreated a whole bunch. You can, you know, hike that trail and see the signs, how far it used to extend 100 years ago, Portage Glacier. So those are the easy things to see, to visualize as retreat. But I think thinning is actually more dramatic to me. So the Harding Ice Field in the last half of the 20th century thinned by 30 meters. So picture 100 feet of ice. So like taller than the tallest buildings in Anchorage. That much ice is gone across the Harding Ice Field. So it's just a tremendous loss of ice. And this graph here shows the USGS has been actually quantifying this on Wolverine Glacier, which is in the eastern Kenai. And just since the 90s, year after year, big drops in the amount of ice. So what does that mean for salmon, though? So in general, having glacial input into a river is going to buffer the river from really hot, dry weather, like I mentioned earlier. So if the glacier goes away completely, you're going to lose that buffering capacity, and that's a risk to salmon. Also, I'm going to show a few pictures from Pluwani Lake here. So if you drive out back when the border was open, when we could drive through Canada, I'm sure many in the audience have driven on the way to Haines Junction and Whitehorse. You pass Pluwani Lake, big, beautiful glacial sapphire lake. And if you, just on your way, before you leave the lake, you cross this big bridge. And if you climbed up the mountain right by that bridge, this is what it looked like before 2016. So it's this huge glacial river flowing in from the south. It's on the right of the photo. And then all that glacial silt settles out, and it turns blue in Pluwani Lake. And then in the outlet of this lake, there's a chum salmon run, and it flows into the Yukon eventually. So starting in 2016, It's like a switch flipped and 90% of the flow of this river got diverted because the glacier that fed it retreated just far enough for the river to change course. So all of a sudden, this is just a big empty wash, and Kluane Lake has dropped dramatically. Some of the bays used to be bays. Now they're little lakes that are disconnected from Kluane. That all the boat launches are dry, and chum salmon are losing spawning habitat in the Kluane River downstream. And just to put this in perspective, this is a little graphic showing where the water used to go. So that little white dot, Kluane Lake, the water used to flow north into the Yukon and out to the Bering Sea. And now the water from this glacier, the Kaskawalsh Glacier, flows south through the Alsek to the Gulf of Alaska. So, and it's happened in 1 year, this change. So we think of glaciers as changing. I mean, glacial, that we use that word to mean something that happens really slowly, but these can be like super dramatic, quick changes in some cases.